From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. The art of the deal. If Republicans can't get their health care bill through Congress this afternoon, the president says he'll walk away and move on. Has repeal and replace morphed into reveal and disgrace? Last October, FBI Director James Comey revealed that he was looking into Hillary's emails. He waited until this week to mention that at the same time, he was also looking into allegations about collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign. Devin Nunes is the chair of the House Intel Committee. He got to visit the White House this week, and he's very sorry about it. Appeals Court Judge Neil Gorsuch has made his pitch to join the Supremes. Chuck Schumer says the Dems will filibuster. And breaking into song at the Everyman Theater as they unveil a new musical. We'll talk to the folks who wrote it. Midday starts right after the news. Hi, everybody. Happy Friday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you have joined us this afternoon. Coming up later today, I'll speak with Michael John Lacusa and Ellen Fitzhugh. They are the composer-writer team behind the new musical of the Everyman Theater. That's coming up later here on Midday. But we start, as we always do on Friday, with the Midday News Wrap. Plenty to talk about today, and we will do so with Juliet Eilprin. She is the senior national affairs correspondent at the Washington Post. She's been keeping a keen eye on, among other things, healthcare, and she joins us on the line from the newsroom of the Post. Juliet, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Of course.
And Dr. Malia Cromer joins me here in Studio A. She's the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center up at Goucher College in Towson. Malia, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome to join us as well. We'll take your calls and comments here at Midday. 410-662-8780 is the number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Juliet, this is a very quickly changing, fast-changing story. Big meeting last night. We understand there was an ultimatum delivered by the administration. What's the latest on the fate of the health care bill scheduled to be voted on today, right, this afternoon sometime?
Yeah, and that's still the plan. It hangs in the balance. The plan is to vote it either up or down, depending on what happens. And interestingly, we've seen folks still come out on both sides today. Almost, you know, what's very interesting is that the traditional strategy of the Republican leadership, and certainly often the Democratic leadership did this too, is that they don't bring a bill to the floor until they are confident that they have sufficient votes to pass it. This is an exception to that general rule because President Trump made it clear yesterday that he wants this bill voted on, up or down, and that at that point he's going to move on. And he did that to put pressure on primarily conservatives who had been reluctant to embrace the bill. And at this point, he is saying that they will have to take responsibility for the Affordable Care Act surviving if they don't vote for this alternative. And at this point, we've had certainly some of the wavering moderates who were inclined to vote against the bill come out this morning and say that they will vote in favor of it because they don't want the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, to stay in place. But we've had a couple of prominent moderates say that the bill is getting worse rather than better with these compromises, and they're going to oppose it. So right now it's unclear whether they have the votes.
Do you have any notion of what the count is? There have been various news organizations trying to keep a count. At one point, earlier this morning at least, it was like 30 who were outliers, and they needed, you know, 21 to pass it.
Right, exactly. I think at this point the count is still, you know, roughly around there. But again, it's fluid. And so I think that it's just at this point, you know, you could – they are within the margin where they could convince enough defectors that they could, you know, that essentially they could pass the bill and you could still have a chunk of, you know, nearly two dozen Republicans vote against it. So they are not at that point, but they certainly have had a couple of those no votes. For example, just to put it in perspective, as of late yesterday, there were closer to 40 no votes. There were 37 at one point, and so they have pared it back some, but they have not gotten all the way there.
So the president is putting pressure on conservative members of Congress, but one of the people feeling a lot of pressure, I got to imagine, is Speaker Ryan. I mean, this vote is really happening at the behest of the president. I mean, if Paul Ryan had his way, we would assume he would keep massaging this thing and hold off on a vote until he thought he could win it. Is that a correct guess?
That is a very accurate description of what's going on. This is not the way he would traditionally operate. And obviously, at the same time, and so his hand was forced by the White House. But it's also worth noting that this, in many ways, is a higher priority for Paul Ryan than it is for President Trump. He has been campaigning and pushing for 7 years to undo this act. And in addition to that, he is very eager to do tax reform and is counting on passing this bill first, which is going to produce savings in the deficit of over $800 billion, so that then he can use that money to enact tax reform later and essentially give out benefits and tax breaks to folks. And so he needs this bill to pass.
And Malia Cromer, if the president loses this, I mean, repealing and replacing Obamacare on day one was one of his many day one promises. I mean, I think we added them all up. He would need 96 hours instead of 24 hours to do everything he promised to do on day one. If he loses and does what he says, which is just walk away and move on to the next thing, you got to think that that's a huge blow to his credibility with his base.
I'm actually really not sure if it is a blow to his credibility. I think for President Trump, the ability to move on from this quickly is actually the best thing for him. So he ran on not only some of these really large policy ideas, but also with this idea that he is somebody who is a great leader who can make deals. And if this inability to make a deal is problematic, and so I think that he would like to move on as quickly as possible and perhaps pivot to start talking about things in which he perhaps can garner more support in the constituency. So things like taxes and infrastructure are two things I think that pull a lot better than healthcare. Because when you start to break up these nuts and bolts of healthcare, we've seen polls from Quinnipiac and Monmouth and CNN come out in the last week, and it really is really damaging, I think, to this Republican narrative, because people do like the individual parts of Obamacare very much. And so this is a situation where it's polling better, I think, than he initially, I think, realized. Healthcare is as complicated as actually he has admitted to an audience earlier about a month ago. And so I think for him, the quicker this is either killed or he can move on from it, the better it will be for his approval ratings.
And Juliet Alperin, I mean, what about Speaker Ryan's contention that you really can't do tax reform? You can't, you know, move forward on a budget which might include infrastructure and that spending and that kind of stuff, that you really can't do that without cutting down the cost of Obamacare?
I think that he has reasons to, you know, to make that argument. And I'd have to differ a little in the sense of yes, it's true that, you know, President Trump can move on and he can blame others for this, but it will be a major blow to his ability to advance his agenda. I don't think anyone would disagree that both as a symbolic move, it's hugely important because he has portrayed himself as a signature deal maker, and on a practical sense, because they need these budget savings. You know, as one healthcare expert remarked recently, this is a Medicaid and a tax cut bill. It's not really a sweeping overhaul of the insurance market the way that some people might think. And so the fact that it is projected by the Congressional Budget Office to save, you know, close to $1 trillion is incredibly important for some of the other initiatives that Republicans are hoping to pass.
And it's not just Trump as a deal maker, but it's the entire Republican Party, as the Speaker has been mentioning, you know, many times over the last few years. We've been promising that we would do this for 7 years. So is it completely off the table that if it fails, if it doesn't go this afternoon, that Ryan would go back to the drawing board and keep whacking away at it and try to come up with something that at least Congress can pass, and then Lord knows what happens when it gets to the Senate? I mean, has Ryan given any indication that even if Mr. Trump is going to walk away, he, Speaker Ryan, would not walk away?
He has not given that kind of indication so far. Again, partially this is a negotiating posture and they're trying to put as much pressure as they can on their members. It's also important to understand that while President Trump has indicated that he would walk away from pushing a bill, there are a number of administrative changes that can be made. You know, the White House, as well as House Republicans and Senate Republicans, have talked about a three-pronged, three-phase approach to doing these reforms, where this bill would be the first part. The second phase would be all the changes that Health and Human Services can do. And the third would be a bill that would require more than a majority vote from the Senate. So in that context, I don't think anyone is walking away from changing the Affordable Care Act. There's plenty that Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary, will do administratively, and that certainly is an option. And then it's a little unclear at this point what would happen legislatively.
And Juliet, we've talked about what might happen to the president's credibility were this bill not to pass this afternoon. But do you think there are any concerns among the Republican caucus about his credibility having been diminished already, which is leading them to think, you know, it's not going to be the worst thing in the world if I walk away from him on this vote?
No, I don't think so. That's not the sense that my colleagues and I have gotten talking to lawmakers and checking in with folks. I think they recognize that while the president is controversial and unconventional in how he operates, he remains fairly popular with many of their constituents who support them. And he has invested considerable time in the last few days to trying to marshal the votes for this legislation. And in fact, even some of the members who are at this point still opposing the bill, like the chair of the House Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, has gone out of his way to praise the president for, in his words, leading and really investing a great deal of time into trying to reach a compromise.
Do you think the impact of these other issues, Paul Manafort, who just today agreed to appear under oath in front of the Intel Committee, the probe by the FBI into Russian influence in the election, do you think that kind of stuff is making it harder for the president to get this bill through?
No. I think that those are issues that matter a lot to Democrats and to some members of the public, but they have almost no impact in how congressional Republicans are operating, view things, view the political landscape.
And the president has been promising this for such a long time, and the folks who voted for him for this particular reason, they're going to be mightily disappointed if it doesn't go through. They're counting on him. For all the people that like Obamacare, there's an awful lot of people who don't, and their premiums have gone up, and they're expecting Trump to fix it. What's his best play, as it were? I mean, if he's not able to fix it, or will he be able to communicate, for example, that this is a three-prong process and it's a marathon, not a sprint? I mean, is he positioned to do that?
He could do that. Quite honestly, my sense is that's not going to be his top communication strategy. His strategy will be to blame the Republicans who voted against the bill, both a number of conservatives and some moderates. And he will absolutely blame House Republicans for bringing this bill down and will not argue that, you know, he could have done something differently, for example. And you know, whether he's successful in that, we'll see. But that will be how he will operate.
And Malia Cromer, I mean, of the people who are currently benefiting from Obamacare, many of them are on Medicaid. This is a lot of kids. 80% of Medicaid spending is spent on children. The bulk of the rest is spent on seniors. Some of them are constituents of these Republican lawmakers. Are some of these folks in a bind? I mean, are they really, is this a really as hard a vote as it appears to be for some of these people?
Sure. I think there's been some anecdotal evidence to suggest that there are the people who have the Trump regret that this was not what they signed up for, that they didn't think their health care would actually be taken away, and they didn't understand that Medicaid expansion, they didn't understand some of the components of the health care law actually benefited them directly. And again, it's the whole idea we've seen in polls time and time again, the disconnect between Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. People have a difficulty realizing those two are the same thing. I really do think, though, the big thing is that the idea of why did people vote for him? And they voted for Donald Trump because he was a change maker. And it will be very easy for him to make the pivot and place the blame for the failure of the congressional Republicans to not get this done. He doesn't want it to be called Trump Care. He's resisted calling it Trump Care, and that's for a very specific reason, because he does not want to be tied to this failure if it does happen. By forcing the vote, I really believe it allows him to force the vote, take a hit, and then move on. Keep in mind, he's only been the president for a little
64
bit,
days.
64 days. So you take the hit early on, you can move on. You have the entire rest of the, you have the a long time, even till midterm elections.
Right. And Juliet Iaprone, I know you have to go and get back to the Hill, but there is at least one Democrat who's voting for the bill. Do I have that number right? Or are all the Democrats unified in opposition?
I don't know of any Democrat who's voting for the bill now. I think what you might be thinking of is that Congressman Bobby Rush from Illinois lost his wife, and he was certainly absent yesterday. And I think there's a question of whether he's absent today. And so
he might not be available to
vote. The
fact
that a Democrat is absent might give them one more vote to play with that they could afford to have, you know, one more Republican defect. But no, unless something's changed, there's not a single Democrat who's going to help them pass this bill.
Juliet Iaprone is the senior national affairs correspondent at The Washington Post. She's also the author of Fight Club Politics: How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives, and she's also written a book about sharks. So, Juliet, we will let you get back to the metaphorical sharks now, rather than the sharks you wrote about
Thanks
in
so much,
your book.
Tom.
And I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Of course.
We'll have more on the Midday News Wrap with Malia Cromer of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College, and we will take your calls and comments. You can join us at 410-662-8780. We'll take your emails at midday@wipr.org. You want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up a little later today, I'll talk to the composer and the lyricist of a new musical that's getting its premiere at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore. And coming up Monday, a conversation about segregation in Maryland schools. Our state is the third most segregated state in the country when it comes to education. And Monday on Midday, I'll talk to Liz Bowie, who is the co-author of a four-part series in the Baltimore Sun called Bridging the Divide. We'll also be joined by Taylor Stewart. She's the regional director at Leadership for Educational Equity. I very much encourage you to read Liz Bowie's story that she wrote with Erica Green, who was with The Sun when she wrote that series and is now reporting on education for The New York Times. But we will have that conversation about segregation in Maryland schools coming up Monday on Midday.
Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it. Get rid of the fraud, get rid of the waste and abuse, but save it. People have been paying in for years, and now many of these candidates want to cut it. You save it by making the United States, by making us rich again, by taking back all of the money that's being lost.
So as a presidential candidate, Donald Trump repeatedly pledged that he was opposed to any cuts in the longstanding federal so-called entitlement programs. Welcome back. It is the Midday News Wrap. My guest is Malia Cromer of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Join us with your questions, comments, and thoughts on what's going on in Washington, what's going on in Annapolis, what's going on in Baltimore, what's going on wherever you live. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Malia, we were talking before the break that you think the president can really sort of just walk away from this. What about Governor Hogan? Is he going to be able to walk away from Donald Trump? Because if, in fact, Mr. Trump takes some sort of hit with his constituency, if he does not deliver on this, you know, oft-repeated promise to, number one, get rid of Obamacare, and number two, leave Medicaid alone, because the $800-plus billion that they're talking about saving comes out of, in large measure, comes out of Medicaid.
So I will say that our poll indicated back in February that among those individuals who disapprove of the job that Donald Trump is doing, around 52% of those individuals still support the job that Larry Hogan's doing. So even among Trump disapprovers, Larry Hogan is doing quite well. And so there hasn't been, to me, a lot of indication of a direct Trump impact on Larry Hogan's approval ratings. And that's because we haven't had any policy coming out of Washington that has right now directly affected either the Maryland – the Maryland economy or Maryland infrastructure. So those are the things that people care about. People care, like, when they evaluate the governor, they think about the economic conditions in the state. And right now, economic conditions in the state are pretty good. And so until the policies of the federal government begin to impact Maryland, that is when people will start to make that direct connection between Hogan and Trump. Even though the Democrats in the state have certainly tried to tie the two together, the connection has to be predicated on economic conditions.
And those economic conditions do stand to be significantly affected if, in fact, Medicaid is cut as much as it might be cut should this bill pass not only the Congress but the Senate. And also, there's so many federal workers in Maryland. The president's budget indicates, you know, just gutting all sorts of programs and all sorts of agencies.
And not only that, the Chesapeake Bay as well. And so cutting the funding to keep with the health and cleanliness of the Chesapeake Bay. So these are the things, again, that the connection between Trump and Hogan, for it to be drawn, it has to be drawn through some sort of policy connection. And right now, again, you're absolutely correct. If we lose a ton of Marylanders lose their jobs because of cuts to the federal government, those are individuals who live in PG and Montgomery County. Those are Democratic strongholds. If they are then enthused to come out in 2018, he will be it'll be damaging to his electoral prospects. But again, we're still kind of waited with bated breath to whether these things will actually occur. And so it really makes a difference if by 2018, by the campaign season, if Maryland starts to feel the effect of what the federal government, the decisions made at the federal government here in Maryland.
Malia Cromer is the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. It's the Midday News Wrap. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let me play a clip of Representative Rosa DeLauro. She's a Democrat from the 3rd District in Connecticut. These were some comments she made just this morning.
Older Americans are going to be hit the hardest. Not only are they going to get an age tax, but they're going to shift $170 billion out of the Medicare Trust Fund, a lifeline for older Americans. And you know what? It makes me believe that this is the case. What does the GOP stand for? Get old people. That's what this bill does.
So Governor Hogan has been asked repeatedly, mostly by Democrats, to, you know, formally and assiduously oppose the GOP health plan. He has resisted that. Is that pressure going to mount? What Trump's polling right now looks to be, according to Gallup this morning, about 39%. There was another poll earlier this week, that had him at 36%. It's historically low for a president this early in a term. Get old people. Is the GOP going to be stuck with that particular encomium?
So, and President Trump's approval ratings here in Maryland are even lower than that we see nationwide. So the Goucher poll, I believe, had him at around a 29% approval rating. So obviously the numbers aren't good. Again, I think that Governor Hogan is waiting to make a formal comment on this until it actually makes it through Congress. So at this point in time, it's just a proposal. It hasn't made it through. We've already had a delayed vote. And so I really do think that he's playing it. He's a very, very cautious politician, and he's waiting to see if it actually comes to be. But I want to just draw on one really quick point. The point about older Americans, and this is the key thing. 2018 is a midterm election, and we know there's one thing we know about that electorate during midterms. It doesn't look young. So midterm elections, we have a lot of older Americans come out to vote, older Marylanders come out to vote. And so if you have a policy proposal that comes and hurts older Americans, that will spell trouble for, I think, the incumbent.
But the governor has proven himself most certainly to be a very adroit politician. He had a 70% approval rating for most of his first couple of years. That number is down a little bit. What's the latest number? And do you read anything into it, the fact that it's beginning to sag?
Well, I mean, I think it's really difficult to contextualize that as beginning to sag when you're at 65% as a Republican governor in a blue state. And so his high was around 71 or 72% back in September. The Goucher poll had him, our polling organization had him around 65, like in the mid-60s in February. Washington Post just came out with their new poll this last week, and it's again in the 60s. A mid-60s approval rating is good for any governor, any sitting governor.
Yeah. Especially there are governors around the country who would kill for that kind of
absolutely.
Rate.
And yeah, so, absolutely. So I always caution against, you know, talking about it as a sagging approval rating. Well, it's sagging from a high of 72%, which is really, I think, an excessive high.
Natalie Sherman, a friend of this show and a terrific reporter for the Baltimore Sun, reported, I think, yesterday that the Census Bureau has released some figures that show that the population of Baltimore is starting to sag, to pick up on that theme, perhaps as many as 6,700 people leaving the city after a brief bump, or at least an evening off of people leaving. As Baltimore's population continues to decline, despite the best efforts and, you know, PR campaigns of Stephanie Rawlings Blake and now Mayor Pugh, do you think the city of Baltimore is also experiencing a diminishing of political clout in the state? I mean, here we have a governor who, you know, there's a narrative that says the governor is just simply not kind to Charm City.
Sure. And I think this idea that Baltimore has lost some of its political clout has it's certainly not a this year thing. This has been a conversation we've been having for at least the last few years. And now we have with the retirement of Barbara Mikulski, who certainly had Baltimore's best interest at heart with her retirement. We no longer have, you know, somebody in the federal government who's really people really thought who's always looking out for that best interest of Baltimore. It really does become interesting, and it becomes interesting with the conversations about school funding, especially with the way we calculate how we fund public schools in the state. As we lose population, we lose a chance at that sort of funding, and it really. We actually, which is really interesting, is we asked individuals on our Goucher poll back in February about whether they thought that Baltimore City was the economic engine of the state. And the majority of Marylanders said no, they do not believe that Baltimore City is the economic engine of the state. Now, Baltimoreans would disagree, and obviously the advocates for the city would disagree, and I think some economists would even disagree with that. But it's this idea of perception, and Mayor Pugh talks about this a lot, that Baltimore City has to sell itself better, has a perception problem, and perhaps that perception problem is preventing individuals to want to move into our city. I'm a city resident. I live in Federal Hill. I love living here. I wish more people wanted to live here.
You know, people point to the fact that the governor canned the Red Line, that he canned mm-hmm. the State Center project, and now he did announce just yesterday an increase in certain parts of the budget from what he had originally suggested, but it did not include an increase for public schools here in Baltimore. You mentioned that this formula that so many people think really needs to be revised is still, you know, there's still that's floating out there. But the governor's office would tell you that he does not have it out for Baltimore. He's making these decisions, you know, on a case-by-case basis. But do you think there is a perception among people here in the city that Governor Hogan is after us?
Sure. And I think it's also very difficult to disentangle partisanship from perceptions of within the city because, you know, this is a city with a 10-to-1 Democratic to Republican ratio. And so there's a general Democratic sentiment that's also driving the perceptions within the city. But we do have a state delegation, a very active state delegation, who have been among the most vocal in criticizing the governor. At the same time, you have Mayor Catherine Pugh, I think, who has on several occasions, the Senate of the Olive Branch, who has really tried, I think, to bridge a gap and to work with Governor Hogan to try to bring the two together. That's the relationship.
And a mayor with more experience in Annapolis than mayors in way, way distant memory.
That, to me, is the relationship will be most interesting moving forward to see if Catherine Pugh is able to broker a deal, because I think she will be the one that will have to broker the deal with Governor Hogan to try to get the city more funding. If that relationship can stand these kind of these trying times and they can come out to some sort of resolution, that it works really well for Baltimore City.
We'll get back to the city, but first I want to go to the phones. Michael in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Malia Cromer. I guess you want to go back to talking about health care for a bit. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good afternoon to both of you. I was just wondering if it would be possible to go back to the way the healthcare system was run before Obamacare.
Well, there are folks that are suggesting that. They're saying that don't worry about the replace part at the moment. Worry simply about repealing it. And were it to be repealed, the assumption is that we would go back to status pro ante or way things were before Obamacare. However, you know, President Obama ran on changing the healthcare system back in 2008, and then Trump ran on replacing it with something that he guaranteed would be lower cost, that would insure everybody, and that would keep those parts of the healthcare plan that people like, insuring your children until they're 26 after they graduate from college, not having a penalty for a pre-existing condition, that kind of thing. So I don't know. There were very few people, at least, you know, 9 years ago, who seemed to be happy about Obama or about the pre-Obamacare healthcare system, which was seen to be very expensive. I mean, Michael, would you yourself prefer your insurance to be what it was before Obamacare, assuming that it would have risen considerably in its cost over these past 9 years?
Well, I don't have a problem with Obamacare, really, but it just seems like President Trump really doesn't know what he's talking about. So I figured if we went back to the way it used to be, at least it worked for a majority of people, it seems.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Michael. I appreciate it. You know, healthcare is, of course, a big expense for the city, for city government and for programs that they're running. But wages are also a big expense for the city itself and for businesses here in the city. Mayor Pugh is faced with perhaps her first big, tough decision. The city council passed a bill raising the minimum wage only in Baltimore to $15 an hour with several exceptions by the year 2022. So this gets phased in. The mayor has been a little cagey about whether she is going to sign it or not. Hasn't signed it yet. What do you think her calculation is going to be about this?
I think Catherine Pugh's calculation always is a pragmatic look for managing the city. She certainly, I think, although she did run on supporting a $15 minimum wage during the campaign, I think she's an individual who probably took a long, hard look at the city budget and has really considering all the implication, all the economic implications of an increase of $15 an hour. But both pro, again, both pro and con, there's a lot of certainly positive implications about raising the minimum wage, which is why I think the majority of our city council pushed forward with this. The idea is, will it detract business interests from Baltimore City? And right now, so along with we are certainly cash strapped. It's not, and so this situation, she has to really consider all the options. It's interesting that we've had other parts of the state, the county executive rejecting raising the minimum wage in other parts. I think it was in Prince George's County, or Montgomery County put a bill like this forward, and it was rejected because of the economic implications. They were afraid of not being competitive. And it'll be interesting to see if Catherine Pugh follows suit or if she decides to sign this bill into law. I believe that they're really close to having a veto-proof majority as well, though, in the city council, so it might not matter.
Yeah, there are 8 new members of the city council elected last November, and I think all of them are very adamantly in favor of a $15 minimum wage. She did run saying that, you know, she was going to represent the boardroom as much as she represents the folks on the streets. Do you see this as a sort of pivotal moment for her in the early on in her tenure?
It is, and it also becomes a really interesting issue in terms of public opinion. So we asked about the minimum wage statewide on our February Goucher poll, and the majority of Marylanders, 60% of individuals support a raise to $15 per hour. This is actually not a
statewide.
Statewide.
And of course, this is what the mayor and others have said, is that yes, it would be a much better thing if everybody had the same thing, or if there were even a federal minimum wage that was $15.
Yes, and you will see even and there are Democrats in the Maryland General Assembly who have floated the idea pushing for what we call the quote-unquote fight for 15, to push that statewide. And interestingly enough, there was a bill early on in legislative session that was since killed in committee that wanted to mandate that individual localities within Maryland were not allowed to raise their minimum wages above that of the state. I think it's interesting that if we start to do, the political calculation, if we start to do a piecemeal approach to increasing the minimum wage, will there ever be a statewide impetus to actually to raise it to 15 statewide if individual localities just decide to do it on their own? And so there becomes a larger, not just city or locality calculation, but a larger statewide calculation for those progressives that are in favor of increasing the minimum wage.
Cardinal William Keeler passed away a few days ago. He's 86 years old. His funeral will be held at the Cathedral of Mary Our Queen on Tuesday afternoon. Does your polling indicate any change, any influence or attenuation of influence of the Catholic Church here in the state of Maryland? Do people think about the Catholic Church as this separate entity? I mean, Cardinal Keeler was very involved in ecumenical work, promoting tolerance between Jews and Christians. I just wonder, and I know this is kind of out of the blue for
sure.
you, but I mean, where do you think the Catholic Church sits in the age of Trump, in the age of Pope Francis, and in the political zeitgeist?
Well, I will say the one thing I can say about public opinion polling is that Pope Francis polls very well. So there has been some studies, some public opinion polls who have asked about him, and Pope Francis is a very popular figure. What is really, I think, what's most interesting in Maryland, and things we actually have never asked about, and we've never asked about the big kind of Catholic issue that resonates in American politics is the idea of being abortion rights, right? Being pro-life or pro-choice. We've actually never asked about that on the Gallup poll, so perhaps maybe we should in the future.
There's a question.
There you go.
anything I can do to help, Malia. All right, Dr. Malia Cromer, she's the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Always good to see you. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, before we go to break, I want to mention a job training event that's being held tomorrow for women of color. The overall female workforce in Baltimore City is 61% Black. However, women of color account for 71% of all low-wage female workers, and Black unemployment overall remains about twice that of whites. So tomorrow afternoon, the Baltimore Black Worker Center will host a panel discussion called From Girls in the Hood to Women in Construction, along with an apprenticeship fair to learn about jobs in the building trades. The center is on South Broadway, and the event runs from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. You can check out our website for the details, wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a break, a conversation with the composer and lyricist of a new musical, Los Otros. It's opening at the Everyman Theater tonight. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.